This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Global trade negotiations aren't usually the scene of high drama, but when the WTO talks fell apart in Cancun over the weekend, the charge was little short of murder. Poor nations accused rich countries of starvation by agricultural subsidy. The United States and the European Union reacted angrily that the charge was unfair and the issue complex, but the accusations have transformed both the politics and the substance of the talks. Whether the cotton in your shirt was grown in Missouri or Mali doesn't seem like a big issue when you try it on in the store, but for the farmer, it can mean a way of life or even life itself. Later this hour, Christine Brennan of USA Today joins us to discuss the demise of the Women's Soccer League and the future of women in professional sports. But first, farm subsidies and international trade. If you have questions about how farm and trade policies actually work, join the conversation. Is it in the national interest to subsidize agriculture? Our balance of trade is an important issue. So is the price of food and textiles. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. With us this hour in Studio 3A to help explain the role of agricultural subsidies in the global economy is C. Fred Bergston, the director of the Institute for International Economics here in Washington. It's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
Start us off with some macroeconomics 101, if you would. How do farm subsidies work in the United States?
Farm subsidies work in several ways. There are direct payments to our farmers for a certain level of output. There are price supports that keep prices of particular agricultural products higher than they would be, and that adds to the revenues that come to farmers. We also protect against imports of certain farm products, particularly sugar, dairy, and a few others. That keeps the domestic market reserved for our local producers. When you put all those things together, you have a fairly widespread support system for farmers of certain products. On the other hand, though, the U.S. is a huge exporter of soybeans, corn, wheat, other products. So we have a big interest in open markets abroad for some of our products. That sometimes becomes a little inconsistent with our protection of our own market for some of our other agricultural sectors.
And you mentioned, it's obviously complicated as to which crops are supported and which are not. But in general, it seems to be grains and soybeans, that sort of thing?
No, those products are not so subsidized. We're very competitive in those products. We export a lot. There are sometimes charges that we help ourselves a little bit with export credit subsidies. But those are not the big products that are subsidized. It's sugar, dairy products, some of the smaller crops like peanuts and such. There is an import control program on beef, which therefore is protected. But it's those more specialized crops, with the big ones being sugar and dairy, that rack up the U.S. subsidies in a big way.
Now, how do our agricultural policies in this regard differ from those in Europe and the European Union?
In broad terms, we, the Europeans, Japan, Korea, and a number of other countries, particularly rich countries, do subsidize agriculture quite a lot. The European Union, though, is the granddaddy of all the subsidizers. Its subsidies amount to hugely larger amounts of money and much greater percentage distortions. Just to give you the numbers, the Europeans provide over 50 billion euros, or $50 billion plus a year, of agricultural subsidies. We have been doing less than 10, although under our new farm bill we may go up close to 20, but still less than half of what the Europeans do. In terms of an analysis of the protective effect of these different agricultural protection devices, ours total up to something like 34% of our agricultural production. The Europeans average a full 100%. The Japanese are 230%. In short, we're a sinner, but we're not nearly as bad a sinner as the Europeans, or even worse on a percentage basis, the Japanese.
Now, what effect do these first world agricultural subsidies have on poorer nations who also have agricultural industries?
Well, the first thing to remember is that the biggest effects of the first world agricultural subsidies are felt by first world agricultural consumers and treasuries, because it's our budgets that you and I pay taxes to that are financing these subsidies, and we pay higher prices for our sugar, for our dairy products and the like, because of the subsidies. Only a small part of the effect actually comes through on the developing countries. Nevertheless, for them, it is very important. The effects come through two devices. As I mentioned, we have high protection on our imports, tariffs, quotas, and the like. That reduces demand for products that the developing countries could otherwise export to us. It limits the amount they can sell us, and it depresses the price. In addition, our subsidies reduce the price of the product by adding to the supply. So even when a developing country farmer can produce and sell, he gets a lower price. You put those two things together, and there is quite a substantial hit to farmers in poor countries. We've calculated that if you got rid of all these subsidies in the first world, literally eliminated them all, which is not going to happen, but right. If you did that, you could lift something like 200 million farmers in the poor countries out of poverty, enable them to live at least a decent economic life.
What about their policies? Are they protectionist? Do they have agricultural subsidies as well?
Many of the developing countries do have import barriers and subsidized programs themselves. In most cases, however, they're too poor to finance anything like the kind of subsidies we have. It's frequently characterized as a competition between those with deep pockets, meaning the rich countries, mm-hmm. and those with much shallower pockets in the poor countries. Even if they wanted to subsidize, they wouldn't be able to afford it. Therefore, their protection, their subsidies are not nearly as great.
Now, how did this become an issue, or how did this come up as an issue in this latest round of World Trade Organization talks in Cancun, as a lot of the developing countries organized themselves into a bloc called the Group of 21?
The issue became very big in the current trade talks for two reasons. The first is that agriculture is the big sector that has been left out of previous international trade liberalization. We've had 8 previous rounds of international trade liberalization negotiations over the last 50 years. As a result, tariffs on manufactured products are down to an average of 2 or 3%. Lots of other things have been liberalized. Agriculture, because it is so politically sensitive in most countries, has basically been exempted. So you get tariff equivalent protection of 100%, 200%, 400% for products like rice in Japan. They have just escaped liberalization. They stand out like a sore thumb as the big sector in world commerce that has not been freed up. Secondly, and you mentioned that, the increased clout of the developing countries in the world trading system. They now have become by far a majority of the membership. They have now begun to get important in economic terms as well. The Brazils, the Indias, the Chinas are countries that we and the Europeans want to get access to. They now have a lot of increased leverage as a result of that. They have come together effectively, really for the first time, used their bargaining power. They used it in a negative sense in this Cancun meeting, essentially to veto moving forward until the rich countries came up with a better deal on agriculture.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's start with Klaus, who joins us from La Jolla in California.
Yes, thank you, Neil. Of course, that program is way too short to go in all to the details.
Indeed.
First of all, my contention is, and I'm absolutely for trade, but totally against the current WTO organization, the way they handle it. But my contention is that it's much better that more trade blocks are formed first before you even attempt to solve all the problems, i.e. that all the countries within South America and Latin America form a trade block similar to the European Union before we get into it. Let me make two really diverse details for that so that your guests can also comment on that. A, way back in the 70s, when the European Union was in the process of forming, there was already a problem within the European Union itself, like the Swiss and the Alpine farmers were depending on having cows, you know, moving up the mountainside in order to preserve the hills, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, they are not able to compete with, like, massive farming operations in Germany or in England, et cetera, et cetera. So if you take that away, you would lose mountainsides, you would have erosions, you would have all kinds of big ecological problems. Well, going back over here to California, we are subsidizing rice in one of the driest regions in the world to produce a water-intensive culture that basically wipes out a 1,000-year-old culture in Japan, where they are depending on their own little rice paddies. And, I mean, I can't go on and on, and, but I think you get the idea. And what we are always have been saying for the last 15 years, and unfortunately only through violent protests and through the credibility loss doing with the Bush administration and stuff, it all comes up right now. But what we have been saying, you know, if you're giving subsidies like $1.4 billion as it is right now in the United States for the cotton farmers, and they own, and it's not really the cotton farmers, it's like five major corporation who get 60% to 70% of that $1.4 billion, it's just insane. Do you get my point?
I may not get your point, but Fred Bergsten, do you get the point?
Well, it sounds like Klaus likes some subsidies and doesn't like other subsidies, and of course everybody's free to pick and choose. But the problem is that most of the subsidies do amount to uneconomic allocation of resources and do amount to a distortion of economic outcomes. Now, one can defend that on the grounds of protecting the Swiss hillsides or the Japanese rice culture. I happen to love traveling in the Swiss Alps and seeing the cows and hearing the bells as they go around.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that providing the huge subsidies per cow that the Swiss provide is really worth killing or making uneconomic the lives of potential dairy farmers around Africa, some parts of Latin America, and other parts of the poor world. It's quite a high price to pay in terms of human suffering in other parts of the world. Likewise, the rice culture in Japan. Rice farming is dying out in Japan. It would be no great burden to the nation or the culture if rice farming was allowed to pass into its history. They can buy equally good rice at prices at 10% of what they now pay. I think there's a strong case, really, for moving against agricultural subsidies in most contexts.
Well, complicating the goals of the Group of 21 is the fact that each country has its own different and complicated relationships with the United States and the European Union. Costa Rica, for example, was one of the countries that signed on with the group, and despite that, it works bilaterally with the U.S. on other trade measures. Joining us now from his office in San Jose, Costa Rica, is Alberto Trejos, who's the Minister of Foreign Trade, and it's good of you to join us today.
Thank you very much. Good for me to be there.
Why did such a polarized stand develop at the WTO talks when at the same time you're working on other trade agreements with the United States?
I would not agree on the notion of a polarized stand. And I think that one sad consequence of what has happened is that this has been portrayed as a North-South issue, for one thing, or as an issue directed at the United States for another thing. And certainly in our case, that hasn't been the case. In two senses. First of all, we have been consistently pursuing reform in agriculture rules in the WTO for a long time as members also of the Cairns Group, which is a group that contains developed and developing countries. It's actually led by Australia and by New Zealand. It contains Canada and also some developing countries like us. And our pursuit there is to have stronger liberalization in trade in agriculture in general, which involves a first pillar of reducing barriers to trade, but also the other two pillars of limiting export subsidies and limiting the most distortive types of internal support along the very same lines that what Fred was saying a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that we were very consistent with that basic tenet that we have been pursuing for a long time, which certainly is not aimed at the United States mostly, since, well, first of all, European subsidies are not 2.5, but rather 3.5 times internal support in the United States. And since export subsidies are mainly applied by the European Union.
Minister Trejos,
this, however,
excuse me,
for us, obviously.
Excuse me, sir. We have to take a break, and we'll hear the rest of your answer in a moment, if you can stay with us.
I'm happy to stay with you.
Okay. Back after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing how U.S. agricultural policies affect global development. Poor countries say first world subsidies prevent them from developing, but how would getting rid of those subsidies really change things? Of course, you're invited to join our conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. With us here in Studio 3A is C. Fred Bergston. I keep throwing an R in there. He's director of the Institute for International Economics in Washington. And with us on the line from San Jose in Costa Rica is Alberto Trejos, Minister of Foreign Trade for Costa Rica. And Minister, I was forced to cut you off there as you were discussing the issue. If you wanted to finish your answer there about the alignment of the Group of 21 and the perception, and it was certainly a strong perception here, is that it was aligned against the U.S. and Europe.
Okay, I think that, well, first of all, we have to answer against that perception. We don't feel that this is a North-South issue. In fact, many countries that don't want to see agricultural reforms, like the ACP countries who feel that the preferential access that they get to the European market today is a consequence of the current rules, were against reform. And at the same time, some developed countries, including Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, have been our partners in seeking reform for a long time. So I don't think it's a North-South issue. At the same time, those of us that have been in this fight for the longest, and that includes countries like Costa Rica, like my own country, who is an active member in the Group of Cairns, are very understanding of the fact that, well, obviously the biggest sinner here is certainly not you, is the European Union. This is not a confrontation, but rather the pursuing that the rules in agriculture become more similar to the rules that we already have in manufacturing, and therefore that we do limit and in some cases eliminate some of the things that we have limited or eliminated in manufacturing policy. We regretted very much that what we were pursuing, which was a negotiation, it was a technical position, it was an alternative proposal for our modalities paper, just like the US-EU paper or like the Cairns paper or like the Japanese paper were, was picked up by the press largely as a confrontation, because that certainly was not our intention. In fact, a country like Costa Rica is strong ally of the United States or Europe in some of the other topics. We were one of the few developing countries that are pursuing significant NAMA reform, something for which the U.S. is a strong supporter. And we are the only developing country that has been, since the very outset, a demander for the Singapore issues, which are very important also for the European Union, and which were the topic, ironically, not agriculture, but rather the Singapore issues, that blocked, in the end, the progress and being able to find an agreement.
Well, Minister, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Alberto Trejos is Costa Rica's Minister of Foreign Trade, and he joined us from his offices at the Ministry in San Jose, Costa Rica. And Fred Bergston, he used a lot of acronyms in there and a lot of, I think, inside talk about what happened at Cancun. Can you decipher some of that for us?
Well, his final point was an important one. The actual breakdown of the meeting did not come over agriculture per se. It came when the European Union in particular insisted on broadening the agenda of the overall trade negotiation to include investment issues, competition policy issues, a couple of other new items which a number of the developing countries just wouldn't agree to put on the agenda. They felt negotiation on those topics in the WTO would be too intrusive, would violate their sovereign rights to do various things, and thus they opposed them. That technically was the issue on which the negotiation broke down, although I would still submit that the underlying topic on which there was fundamental disagreement was how far to go on agricultural trade liberalization. That really was the substantive problem. The minister was also right to say that Costa Rica has frequently worked with the U.S. You noted that they're now negotiating a bilateral free trade agreement between the United States, Central Americans as a whole. But I'm afraid what you said was right, Neil. The media portrayal of the outcome in Cancun was a confrontation between the poorer countries and the richer countries. That may well lead to some backlash here, including in our own Congress, that would make it more difficult not only to proceed on the WTO negotiation, but even some of these more bilateral or regional free trade talks, like with Costa Rica and its Central American partners themselves. There is a negotiation actively underway now. It's already going to face a lot of opposition to Congress, and the spillover from Costa Rica, from the Cancun blow-up, mm-hmm. could in fact jeopardize that.
Well, we can get a readout on that right now. Joining us now from Capitol Hill is Senator Charles Grassley, a Republican from Iowa. He heads the Finance Committee, which is the Senate body in charge of U.S. trade agreements. Senator Grassley, always good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, and this is such an important issue that you're discussing, because free trade, the process of WTO goes a long way towards breaking down barriers to trade. Trade enhances the economic pie worldwide, and having more for more people that are being born every day, and reducing the political it brings more political stability and humanitarian needs to people.
Well, Senator, as we were just discussing, I mean, did this break down, in your opinion, on a north-south divide? And do accusations that we've heard from at least some in the developing world that the U.S. and Europe promise a lot but don't deliver very much, and that agricultural subsidies among the rich nations are helping to starve their farmers and ruin their agriculture? What's going on here?
Well, how do you know for sure what's going on? But I see a little bit of exercise of political muscle by countries that felt that they haven't been given proper attention in the past. But also, I see it as a very unrealistic approach that they take. Either countries believe in open trade or they don't, and the attitude in Cancun of many potential free trade partners makes me question their commitment to free trade and open trade, and obviously trade's a two-way street. It's not realistic to ask developed nations to give everything and offer nothing in return, and we were more or less dictated to on in regard to agriculture, when in fact, the process that's proved so successful for the last 50 years, GATT and now WTO, is a process of negotiating and considering everybody's point of view, and everybody gives and takes a little bit, and you've got to be at the table. So how could you complain about Europe not reducing enough if you aren't willing to sit down and negotiate with them?
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller involved here. Greg joins us now on the line from Princeton, California.
Hi.
Hi, Greg.
I'm one of those subsidized rice farmers that an earlier caller alluded to. And actually, I'm sitting on my combine right now. But I wanted to say that with regards to subsidies, I don't think the farmers are the big winners here. And I think that, at least in U.S. farm policy, the farm bill has been written by Cargill and ADM and the large grain companies to benefit them, to provide cheap, stable raw materials for their products. And I'd be just as happy if all the farmers around the world were doing well.
So you don't feel much like a sinner as you sit there on your combine?
I do not.
Let me just ask Senator Grassley just to expand on your comments, Greg. Figures from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, say 90% of the farm subsidies in the U.S. go to the top 25% of farmers. It doesn't sound like mom-and-pop farms that the subsidies are often portrayed as supporting.
Well, I use the figure 10% goes or 10% gets two-thirds of the benefits, and obviously the rice farmer listening knows about my efforts to put an absolute cap on the amount of money that a family farmer could get, because we've always directed our farm program towards medium and small-sized farmers. So I have some sympathy for that point of view, but you don't solve that issue as far as the developing nations are concerned by walking away from Cancun, by putting demands on the table. What you do is you put on the table what you want to negotiate, and we're willing to negotiate our farm program.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much.
Can I make one more comment?
You can. Go ahead.
As far as that 10%, or, the subsidies go, 90% of the subsidies go to 10% of the farmers or whatever it is, our farm is placed in that large farm category based on gross sales of, I think $500,000 is what the USDA uses. Our farm is my dad and I. We run the entire operation. There's no hired people. And we are considered a large farm. And so I think just using gross sales is misleading, because if we're the biggest farm in the country, we are not in good shape.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much, and yep. good luck on with your crop this year.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate it.
Bye.
Let's go now to Brenda, and Brenda joins us from Mexico, New York.
Hi, I'm a dairy farmer, and I first would like to say, Greg, I absolutely agree with you on the big ag companies, and also the processors are the other big winners in the subsidy program as it stands right now. The other thing that I would like to give voice to is the fact that in developing nations, they don't have the land and school taxes that we have. They don't have the cost of production. They don't have the same regulations to have to come into compliance with. And I think that unless you look at the cost of production in comparison to the cost, you know, the price that you're getting, American farmers are getting killed already. And I'm not sure that the people in Washington really pay close enough attention to that, because the farm margin right now is very, very, very small, and we're losing farmers every day. And in reference to the comment about Japan not needing to produce its own rice anymore, if I were Japanese, I'd be really worried about that, because the attitude in the 70s was that the United States didn't have to necessarily maintain its own fuel supply anymore. And I think there's some people in the Southwest that were a little upset about the energy shortage. Imagine if that was a food shortage.
Brenda, what kind of farming do you do?
Dairy.
Dairy, New York State, if memory serves, the second largest dairy state in the union. Senator Grassley, get a comment?
Well, the comment is that she's absolutely right. And we raise these questions about Brazil, whether or not there's not a lot of subsidy for agriculture in Brazil. And yet Brazil is leading the 21 nations that walk out. Putting demands on the table. And all of these issues are taken care of in negotiation. And that's the way it's worked for 50 years. And what's wrong with negotiation? In other words, Cancun could have decided to negotiate, and we could have gone on several months to negotiate with these 21 nations that walked out. And if at the end they didn't like what was negotiated, they could have walked out then. Why walk out in the middle of negotiations?
Brenda, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Senator Grassley, we know you've got to go, but in a statement you wrote from your office, you said that you would, quote, take note of those nations that played a constructive role in Cancun and those nations that didn't. What did you mean by that?
Well, for instance, you just had a spokesperson for Costa Rica on. Costa Rica was one of the 21 nations that were working against negotiations. Do they believe in free trade or don't they? They come begging to me that they want to be part of the Central American Free Trade Agreement with America. Why would they want to negotiate with America a bilateral agreement if they don't want to negotiate globally? It doesn't make sense to me. So, Costa Rica, Guatemala were part of the 21 nations. They're part of the five nations negotiating with us now. Maybe the only real negotiations we ought to have are with the other three countries.
Senator Grassley, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks very much for your time today.
Okay, goodbye.
Iowa Republican Charles Grassley heads the Senate Finance Committee. He joined us today from the U.S. Capitol. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And C. Fred Bergstrom is still with us. Here's an email we got from John Richards. With the elimination of agricultural subsidies, what's to prevent agribusiness from moving to low-cost countries to take advantage of lower wages and reduced environmental concerns, much as with the migration of manufacturing to low-wage environments?
Well, one of the objectives of getting rid of the subsidies in rich countries, as I said before, is to permit producers in poorer countries to get a bigger market share and get a higher return on their product. As I said, doing so would permit a couple of hundred million farmers in poor countries to be lifted out of poverty. That means, as you suggest, there would be a shift in the sourcing of production of some products to those countries.
But would foreign investors, major in international corporations, be allowed to go and buy up that farmland and produce in overseas countries?
That would depend on the laws of the other country. certainly from the standpoint of U.S. law and the international trading rules, the answer would be yes. We encourage investment and therefore production to go to the most economic source. Now, the caller also asked about low environmental standards. There's a big debate about how to avoid races to the bottom, pursuing low environmental standards to take advantage of unfair competition. That is increasingly an element in trade negotiations. It's now an element in any trade pact that the United States negotiates, and that practice certainly is resisted and, to the best we can, rejected by U.S. policy and international agreements.
Let's go now to Lark, who's with us from Minneapolis.
Hi, Neil. I'm enjoying the conversation.
Thank you.
It strikes me that a significant piece of ag subsidies in the U.S. is the consumer's near refusal to pay the actual cost of their food. And I was wondering if your guest could talk about this and any research he may have done on how and if consumer attitudes may change.
What do you mean by the actual cost of the food?
Well, I forget the percentage. I'm sure your guest knows, but something like Americans pay the lowest per capita cost for their food.
I see.
Just the, what rate the subsidies go towards kind of decreasing the price at the cash register.
The price at the cash register as opposed to in our tax form, but go ahead.
Sure.
Well, it's correct that Americans pay the lowest price for food in the world, but that's primarily because American agriculture is the most productive in the world. American agriculture, despite these distortions that we're talking about, is, on the whole, extremely productive, is able to produce and turn a profit at low prices. It's a very competitive industry, as a number of our callers have indicated. There is competitive pressure to keep prices down. The subsidies may add to that in some cases, but in the big agricultural products, the ones that make up most of our consumer market basket, the low prices that we do enjoy as consumers here in this country are really a result of the basic economic forces of large land mass, high capital investment in irrigation, other capital inputs, large machinery component of our farming, and therefore a result of the traditional and typical productive forces in any economic activity.
Lark, thanks very much for the call. We just have a few seconds left, but after you heard Senator Grassley's reaction in terms of the politics of this, where do you think this is going?
I think and hope that the blow-up in Cancun will be constructive. It will lead each of the major countries, both the rich countries and the poor countries, to go back home and improve their offers for this trade negotiation. Senator Grassley rightly said that the poor countries, while correctly demanding more from the rich countries, cannot just sit on the sideline and fail to participate themselves. They've got to play a role. The other side of the equation, however, is the risk that Senator Grassley and other politicians will take away a very negative image from this negotiation, will not want to deal constructively with the countries involved, and therefore the trading system could suffer a serious blow. It's going to depend on whether our governments play it constructively from here on out.
C. Fred Bergston is director of the Institute for International Economics here in Washington. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
We'll be back after a break with soccer, tennis, basketball, and figure skating. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.